Welcome to A Cult of Personality at acultofpersonality.net. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to A Cult of Personality, esoteric podcast extraordinaire. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and you can find our website at occultofpersonality.net, featuring an extensive archive of recorded interviews. A Cult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and by the subscribers to the A Cult of Personality membership section. Membership provides access to a tremendous archive of interviews for a low monthly fee, while helping to support the production and distribution of the show. Please consider subscribing if you haven't already. This episode is also made possible by additional donations from Steve, Lance, and an anonymous donor. Thanks again. A Cult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. Now, in episode number 142, our guest is Lee Gerard Barlow. Lee is a mesmerist, healer, and teacher. You can find his website, Arcana Therapies, at arcanatherapies.com. Lee has been working therapeutically with trance states, meditation, and yoga-based practices for the past 20 years. He trained as an NLP master practitioner with Dr. Richard Bandler's Society of Neuro-Linguistic Programming and studied hypnosis and hypnotherapy with the Institute of Clinical Hypnosis in London. He treats clients using individually tailored therapies based on his expertise in these disciplines. Lee is an official premier trainer for ISI CNV International, the Continental School of Dr. Marco Perret, teaching the arts of magnetism, mesmerism, fascination, and presence-based therapy. Lee occasionally hosts courses and has written articles for magazines and online journals. See the links in the show notes. As you'll hear in the interview, mesmerism is not just a historical artifact, but a living system that is practiced and taught. In addition to the practical, we'll explore the more esoteric roots of this fascinating discipline. Lee Gerard Barlow, welcome to the show. It's really a pleasure to speak with you, and I appreciate you joining us today.
It's very good to be here, for sure.
For people who don't already know of you and your work, can you just tell us a little bit about your background and maybe how you became interested in esotericism?
Probably a good place to start is when I was very young, I grew up in a village called Acworth, which is in northern England. And I do believe there's also an Acworth in Atlanta as well. In this particular village, we had quite a lot of ceremonies going on. Maypole dancing, Morris dances, things like this. Quite a lot of old traditions were kept in place. And so this formed a background to my childhood when I was there. And just as an aside, Acworth itself is an old English word, which means oak grove. So this particular place was also known to be an oak grove. where things were said to have happened in previous times and so on and so on. The whole place itself was steeped in a lot of village talk about peculiar experiences that people were having there. And my own family, and even I myself, in the house I grew up in, which was a very old house, we all had peculiar experiences from time to time. When I was about 19 years old, I moved to London. And after being in London for a little while, I decided to go on a walk called the Coast to Coast Walk, which goes from a northern part of England, starting on the west coast and ending on the east coast, obviously. And what's interesting about this particular walk, though, is that it follows some very ancient tracks, which go back to prehistoric times. There's one particular part of the walk called the Lykewake Walk, where the Lyke being the name for the double, very similar to the Egyptian car, if you like. And this was an ancient trackway where the corpse was ceremonially walked across to mark the passage on the earth matching the path in the sky, i.e. the Milky Way in this instance. Very interesting experience. But on that particular walk, I had some very peculiar trance experiences and particular states where I went into conditions which I now regard as being states of presence. So walk, after doing these things, I think that the important thing about that particular walk is that it was very pivotal as an experience, coming of age, leaving home and so on, of literally putting me onto a track, onto a path in a literal sense, and in a metaphorical and spiritual sense, you might say. I was a musician, always been a musician as well. I've recorded a few records here and there under the names of Chemical, did an album in 1995 called Chemical, did an album in 1996 called Mother Yod, and I've also had an album, records out and performances did under the name of Sir Francis Dashwood and the Hellfire Club. And all of these things can be found to some measure on the net if you look for them, YouTube and so on. And there was always forms of magical and Gnostic themes running throughout these recordings. So I've been practicing now what we could call the art of magnetism in lots of different forms for many years now. But in the early days, I didn't know it was specifically referred to as mesmerism as such. So my interests and studies over the last 18 years or so eventually came full circle when I began working with a school in Nice run by Dr. Perret, who I've been studying with for quite some time now. And while I was a musician, to refer back to that, I actually experienced quite a lot of those trance states during freeform work as a musician, during recording sessions on stage, and as I say, on the lengthy walks that I did, such as the Coast to Coast Walk. And through this, I started to become more and more interested in what trance was, how to achieve trance states, and I suppose ultimately how consciousness actually experiences itself. Mm. And what indeed consciousness actually is, that became an important question for me as well.
It resonates, I think, with probably a lot of people listening when you ask those questions that are so profound. Now, I've heard of Franz Mesmer, and I know a little bit about mesmerism from your work and talking with you, but could you tell us a little bit more about where this all comes from, who it was that developed it, and just explain it in a little bit more detail to give it some historical context.
Well, Franz-Anton Mesmer himself was an extremely interesting chap. He, I have his dates of birth here, 1734, and he lived until 1815. Franz Mesmer himself, he was a Freemason and a patron also of Mozart, which many people may not know. He actually had belief in a specific type of energy. I refer to it as an energy. He believed in the universal fluid. This formed the basis of his healing art. And the universal fluid is something which has obviously been a contentious issue. It's been something which has a lot of people have argued for and against. But in a way, the way I understand it is that Franz Mesmer himself was actually using that like a metaphor, if you like. I don't think he was being literal when he was talking about a universal fluid as such.
So I don't mean to interrupt you, but I think it's an important point, and I don't want to forget it, is when you were describing this universal fluid, and you mentioned he interprets this perhaps metaphorically, it really invokes this idea in ancient art of this, the idea of the fountain, which I think you can find in a lot of different examples. So just wanted to mention that.
Oh, absolutely, for sure. You know, you have the idea of the fountain and the fountain of regeneration and all of these types of things cropping up in a lot of areas. And in mystical systems and so on, and myth. But the universal fluid itself, you know, like it's a form of allegory, if you like, is sort of how I'm looking at it, really. I think for those listeners out there who tune into your show, tune in, so to speak, regularly, they will be of the form of mind whereby they're ready to understand that things are not literal. Whenever the adepts speak of these things, they are not speaking in a literal sense. And I think this is something that people of a more scientific mind will always have difficulties with. So obviously later we will, I'm sure, talk about how these things relate to scientific concepts in the present time, but and how that can be a problem, how it has been a problem in the past and how it may well continue to be so. But in real terms, the adepts always spoke in metaphor, as I'm sure your listeners know.
So Mesmer developed this system, and then his ideas propagated very rapidly, I assume, during his time period.
Well, I mean, Mesmer was going around making lots of demonstrations, causing quite a stink, if you like, over in France. He was very, very popular amongst the nobility, and this was prior to the point in time where prior to the French Revolution. So obviously during the French Revolution, mesmerism most definitely took a duck down into obscurity. And he even spent, I do believe, a very short time over here in England, in London, I think. He came over here. Lived in relative obscurity. I mean, no one really knew who he was over here. During the time that he moved to London, obviously the whole of the mesmerism explosion, if you like, over in France actually went into a sort of ducked underground for a little while. Basically what happened is after Mesmer's death, this was the part where it started to split, started to fracture. So after Mesmer's death, magnetism, which is also the art of mesmerism, is obviously mesmerism was named after Franz-Anton Mesmer, who popularized it. But what we had was a system which many also know as animal magnetism. To refer back to Mesmer himself for a moment, what actually happened with Mesmer was that he learnt the art from a priest, which he used to see working away, doing healings in his vicinity. And that particular priest, as I understand it, used to actually work with magnets themselves. So he used to actually work with magnets. And for a little while, Mesmer experimented with these methods. And he got good results. But it finally dawned on him that he could dispense with the magnets altogether. He started to understand that this vital fluid that he had access to, that he believed in, was actually something which worked on a level whereby there were certain magnetic polarities in the body itself, in the human biosystem. So therefore, he would work with this, imagining the fluid moving from one side of the body to the exact point on the other side of the body, and so on and so on. So if he felt an imbalance in one area, he would move it over to the other area, and so on, until a state of equilibrium and harmony was achieved. So this was the basic method behind Mesmer's universal fluid. And he, like I say, he imagined it as a fluid. It's probably, that was his working paradigm, if you like.
Yes.
And so what happened was, after his departure and after him, you know, getting rid of the magnets,
mm-hmm.
he would, there was different schools of thought which arose from the workings of animal magnetism. And they fell into the branches of Mesmerians, following the works of Mesmer directly, psychofluidists, and spiritualists. Now, the spiritualists were the ones that sort of went off and worked within certain societies. And this is something that a lot of your listeners may find of interest. Some of these societies, through the works of Puysegur, who followed Mesmer, who was working with the more sort of psychofluidist school, took this work and, with other characters like Dom Panetti,
mm-hmm.
there was a specific area called specific point in time called the Paris Convent,
mm-hmm.
and the Paris Convent was a point where Cagliostro, Louis-Claude de Saint-Martin, and Puysegur, and so many of these occult luminaries were around in the Paris Convent at the time. In any case, what this did was it spread the word of mesmerism through all of these societies. Mesmer himself was also there, of course, at the Paris Convent. And Puysegur took this, and various schools set up in places like Lyon and Avignon in France. And what happened was the work continued through the schools of schools with a Martinist basis, through the likes of characters like Willemots,
mm-hmm.
Louis-Claude de Saint Martinez de Pascali also brought in certain currents into this as well. So there was a lot of really, really very interesting characters working with animal magnetism in France at that time. So this is something that I wish to impress upon your listeners, is that a lot of very well known occult luminaries, as you may call them, in that particular part of French history, which are very well known to us all now, Cagliostro himself, for example, they were all familiar with these techniques.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a very important point and eloquently expressed. So I think it's important we keep that in mind during our conversation, because I think we're going to be returning to that again. Before we go any further, I just want to mention, for people who haven't already seen the video you put on YouTube of the mesmerism or magnetism session, you have to see that. it is important to see it in action, I think. And I'm just wondering if you could say just a little bit about the technique and how it is for you when you're doing it.
Right, indeed. Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are actually at the moment, as we speak on this interview, there will be more coming up soon. But at the moment, there are three videos that I've posted up on YouTube. They give various different aspects to the way it works. I think the one that you're specifically referring to is the one where we're seeing an act of magnetism taking place.
Right. Yeah.
Now, there's all sorts of different methods going on here, but the predominant one of which you'll see on the videos is that of what's called magnetic passes. Now, the magnetic passes are actually very slow movements over the subject that you're working with. But the most important ingredient is that the practitioner themselves must be in a state of, as I've said, of presence. It's very important that while one is working with these methods, that one is completely and utterly present. What I mean by that is that, in a sense, one is in a state of non-conceptuality. You're not in your mind as such. One is completely in a non-conceptual state. And this is something that takes a great deal of work, a great deal of practice, a lot of patience, because what you're essentially doing is you are overriding certain principles which are very, very natural to a human, i.e., you know, the way the mind is continually reeling on, judging experience, and so on and so on.
Now, do you mind if I ask, do you have any physiological sensations or ways of recognizing that you're Yes. now in that state?
Absolutely, absolutely, yes. As one is working the magnetic passes and so on, one becomes aware. And as I say, as the deconceptualizations, as the conceptualizations of the mind fall away, one receives an one may experience it as an influx of energy, where initially the body becomes one mass of vibration. And this being a constant awareness that one never loses has a shifting effect upon the recipient. So the recipient themselves actually no longer experiences their position in space and their perception of time to a large extent, or sometimes radically, dissolves away. And so when this occurs, there is something peculiar that can take place. This is when the practitioner and the subject, in a sense, form one unit. They become entangled with each other. And this is where we may begin to start mentioning the ideas that have been common to quantum physics, such as quantum entanglement and so on. I know that as soon as one mentions these ideas, that it can seem perhaps like pseudoscience or something like that. But in actual fact, we as a school, as I say, working with the School of Nice, we as a school, the school that I'm actually part of, over in Nice with Dr. Perrette, we work on the principle that for now, the paradigm, the quantum paradigm, if you like, is a useful one that we can work with. It may shift at some point in the future. It may be something which is no longer relevant because new research comes along all of the time. But The interesting thing about the quantum paradigm is something that a lot of people may not be aware of, is that it, in actual fact, it comes directly from mesmerism itself. And I'll explain exactly why that is. Because basically, in Germany, you had Schopenhauer. Now, Schopenhauer himself actually created a book called On the Will in Nature. And in that book, there was a chapter called Animal Magnetism and Magic. So Schopenhauer wrote this book specifically on animal magnetism. Now, Schopenhauer actually directly influenced Schrödinger. Schrödinger was a huge fan of Schopenhauer's writings, mm-hmm. and took a great deal from Schopenhauer's views on animal magnetism. So for those out there who are familiar with Schrödinger and the whole Schrödinger's cat theory, there was also around that time, later on there was Niels Bohr as well, other physicists, who are now regarded, if you like, as the original fountainhead of what's called quantum mechanics. The other major mistake that people make is that people believe, in the common perception, that quantum mechanics is something strictly related to the physical world and physical measurements. And this is not the case. One only has to actually read back into the original sources of Schopenhauer, Schrödinger, and so on, and to actually realize that often what's being put forward is actually that the ratios of measurement and so on are actually related to dimensions that are actually also on the mental plane. And so the whole idea of waveforms and collapsing of waveforms and so on and so on come directly from the works of such figures as Schrödinger, Schopenhauer, and the influence that he had upon these figures. So this is something very important to research and to hold in mind.
That is absolutely fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. I did not expect to hear that today.
Yes, so this is what I'm saying. It comes directly from these people. You know, people are running around talking about quantum physics, thinking that the current wave of magnetists are actually like pulling this in to magnetism, when in actual fact it comes from magnetism.
Wow, that's quite profound. Now, you mentioned the school that you're a part of.
Yes.
Could you say a few words about Dr. Perret and his school?
Yes, for sure. Well, he's a remarkable figure, a remarkable teacher. He's been running the school for a number of years now. He started very much in Italy and France, mainly Italy, and then into France, started working with NLP. He came from the disciplines of NLP, started teaching courses in these things. And due to his own interests, he took these things forwards a great deal, and started introducing the ideas of what he may well regard as the next logical level. He was originally teaching a specific system of NLP. I mean, I'm trained in NLP as well, in clinical hypnosis. And these particular disciplines have ultimately led me on to meet Dr. Perret. And because he was actually teaching a system called NLP3, which he regards as the next logical level of, he regarded then as the next logical level of NLP, because in NLP we have a system called logical levels, which is out there for people who wish to research that. I mean, that's something which if we went into now would probably digress too far, but so the next logical level is taking things to a point where we go beyond the identity level, because in the logical levels we have the environmental level, the way that the environmental level has effects upon us and so on, and then our beliefs and capabilities, beliefs and values, our capabilities, and different levels like this, until we get to like the identity level. And we use these levels in NLP as a way of getting people to work out various things, various problems on a therapeutic level. Now, the identity level itself is very much the sense of who one is. But as we know in the esoteric traditions, you know, that's the ultimate question, one may say, you know, to know thyself. So to take it beyond the identity level into the level of the free form energy, this is where we start getting into the areas that we were just speaking about. It's touching upon that part, that aspect of things, whereby one is in touch with what the physicists called the zero point energy. This is what we essentially work with.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to reach that point, is a perceptual thing. So the practitioner themselves has to be able to perceive reality in a different way. And as I say, that takes a specific amount of training. The reason why I mention all of this is because this is what we do in Dr. Perret's school.
What are some of the benefits, or maybe a better way to ask it is, what are some of the conditions that magnetism is useful in treating?
It's useful in so many different ways. The way that I've most commonly used it with people is for things like nervous complaints and so on and so on. But I mean, that's just, magnetism itself can be used to bring a person back, essentially to bring them back into a state of presence. The key element is the state of presence, which I keep mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
If the individual can actually let go of their conceptualizations while they're in the experience of the magnetized state, which is known in various forms as magnetic sleep, it's also known as magnetic ecstasy. But what it really is it's a form of awakening, which is very contradictory to a lot of people's perceptions of what hypnosis is, because hypnosis, hypnos, the god of sleep, named after the god of sleep and so on. But it wasn't the magnetists who actually came up with the name hypnosis. It was James Braid in the mid-1800s who came up with the name hypnosis while he was putting the whole phenomena of animal magnetism into a kind of debunking session. He was busy trying to... Okay, James Braid was an ophthalmist, and he was there in Manchester, and he wanted to scientifically study in the 1800s, wanted to scientifically study the phenomena of animal magnetism. There was a traveling mesmerist at the time called Charles LaFontaine, which I do believe he studied. And being an ophthalmist, he became particularly interested in the effects upon the nervous system, because he also studied the muscular system as well. So he was looking at the effects of light. He was looking at the effects on the muscular system and upon the nervous system. And he was studying these things from a medical perspective. And he regarded that, he understood it, that there was nothing happening which was of a mystical nature. These were his conclusions. And this is where the phenomena of what we now know as clinical hypnotism was founded upon Braid's assumptions. Or should I say Braid's conclusions.
I don't know if you want to say any more about this differences between hypnosis and magnetism, or the acceptance by the general public of one versus the other, or anything.
The differences are, I'll come to some essential points here, especially with the School of Nice, because I see the School of Nice as being a very special case in point. I'm also eager to point out to people that not only is there the school in Nice, but I also myself run workshops here in the UK for people who are listening and are able to attend them here in the UK. I'd be more than happy to engage with students on that level. If you go to www.arcanatherapies.com, so if you take a look at the website, you will find links to various videos, essays, and you will also find the latest information about course dates that are taking place here in the UK, as well as being able to trace over to links for Dr. Parrett's school in Nice as well. So as I was saying, regarding the differences of hypnosis and magnetism, essentially speaking, we have hypnosis as it is today, hypnotherapy especially, and NLP, which is a sort of hyper-packaged form of various therapeutic forms that Dr. Richard Bandler and John Grinder put together in the 1970s, which has become very popular since those times. But anyway, the major difference between these things and the true action of mesmerism, as it's especially practiced in the current day in the School of Nice, is that all these therapeutic forms, such as the hypnotherapy and the NLP, actually work on the mental plane. Because hypnosis works through verbalization, through verbal suggestion, and through implication. And so what happens is you're working on the tendency of the mind to be able to link ideas together, usually to do with the past, because you're working on situations of the past, but actually linking that to implications of the future. And through these various ways of directing the mind, one can cause therapeutic shifts to occur in the individual. But the major point I'm making is that with these other disciplines, what actually takes place is it's a bit like, to put it in, if you like, the difference between, say, high magic and sorcery, is that high magic is working on the purely energetic planes, the non-conceptual plane. Whereas lower forms of that magic, one might say, sorcery, as I've said, may be equated in some level to various forms of hypnosis and hypnotherapy. Now, I say this because what you're doing is you're rearranging existing conditions for a different outcome, rather than bringing purely new energy in from a higher plane. So what mesmerism does is actually do the opposite. It brings energy in from the higher plane, rather than working on the conceptual lower planes, where you're just rearranging the conceptualizations of the individual who's engaging in the process.
That's an interesting distinction.
Yes. So what also happens is through the training that we're talking about in presence, for example, working with the aspects of presence, is that you're actually raising the vibrations, which is the true aim of alchemy. Also, as I understand it, you're actually raising the vibrations of the vessel of the body. And through these processes, we gain what may be called siddhis. And these siddhis are what you see in the videos.
So once again, I'd encourage people to check those out. I don't know that there's any better way to get a grip on exactly what you're talking about than to see it in action.
Well, I would say see it in action, but better still experience it.
Yeah, that would be number one, yeah. But if you can't experience it, definitely check it out on YouTube. So I'll include those links in the show notes. I want to take a quick detour here because I feel like this is a point that's crucial, but yet maybe so simple that it's glossed over, overlooked oftentimes. And that's the idea of esoteric practice that is intended to heal in a practical way. And I feel like this idea of healing is crucial to, how do I say this, demonstrate the viability of the esoteric stream, or you mentioned these Martinist streams. You mentioned also the priest that sort of clued Mesmer into all of this in the first place. So there's a deep history within the Catholic Church, and I think most major world religions, of healing that goes on. And I feel like in modern times, the focus in a general sense is not really on healing itself. It may be in a general way, but the type of work you're doing stands out because it's certainly in that tradition, like you mentioned, Cagliostro, Mesmer, even to people like Master Philippe in France, or, you know, all of the priests and other, you know, lay people who've done healing in the name of their religion. So I just wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, well, like you say, the major point is that this is not theoretical. This is, as you pointed out, it's not theoretical. It's something which is completely experiential. It's also something that if one wishes to practice the art of magnetism, one must engage in aspects of self-development. It's an absolute prerequisite. It can't be done without actual application and work. These things are very, very important. And at the same time as well, you know, one may, through one's words, as I've said, you know, change existing conditions, which can be healing. You can trigger things from the psychological plane through various, as I say, forms of suggestion and so on, which can actually affect even the physical body itself, because, of course, everything's completely linked to each other. Brain and the central nervous system and so on, and the glandular system and the way that it secretes things into the blood and into the plasma of the body. But with this, with these particular forms are much more, as you say, practical and much more direct. They are working with something else.
Do you ever have to respond to people who, you know, ask you, like, is magnetism like the Western form of Reiki?
Yes, that's a very common response, you know, because people see what I do and they go, oh, it's so similar to Reiki, and they immediately draw parallels. Well, essentially speaking, you know, one is working with energy. I mean, for example, certain other systems work with chi and so on and so on. But to me, this is not chi or those types of energies. This is something of perhaps, I mean, there is a saying, you know, that if you focus on the chi stagnates. This is something that various people who work with Chinese therapies often say. And I would say that, you know, this is not about focusing on anything. So therefore, you don't focus on the energy. It's drawing it from a different point, which is where it becomes very, very, very difficult to explain it. But I something I'd like to mention is the fact that you know, we have the symbol of the universal agent in Levy's work, for example, which I do believe is one of the points you may have wished to discuss today. What's interesting about it is, for example, if we take a look at the introduction, I'll just bring this up as an aside, a very important one. We have the concept of that force we're talking about, embodied in the glyph or the image of Levy's Baphomet, for example. And this being a glyph for the universal agent. And in that introduction, there's this particular quote, which says, "There exists in nature a force which is immeasurably more powerful than steam. And a single man who is able to adapt and direct it might change thereby the face of the whole world. This force was known to the ancients. It consists in a universal agent having equilibrium for its supreme law. I'll just stop there in there. It's the key word there being equilibrium. This was the very essence of Mesmer's philosophy, was a state of equilibrium had to be brought into being in the individual. It's this state of equilibrium that actually allows the so-called healing to take place. Because wherever there is, like in Chinese medicine, wherever there is imbalance, there is a form of disequilibrium, which invariably causes some form of illness.
Mm.
And so I'll continue here. The universal agents has equilibrium for its supreme law, while its direction is concerned immediately with the great arcanum of transcendental magic. This agent is precisely that which the adepts of the Middle Ages denominated the first matter of the great work. The Gnostics represented it as the fiery body of the Holy Spirit. It was the object of adoration in the secret rites of the Sabbath and the temple under the hieroglyphic figure of Baphomet or the androgyne of Nandes, and so on and so on. So, this is also known quite often in the book Transcendental Magic, where he refers to it as the astral light, as well as the universal agent. These terms can all get very, very confusing, but if we take a look at the figure, which we've referred to already as Baphomet in Levy's work, we have all the opposites are united within this single figure. So you have the angelic, you have the beastly, you have the wings for the airborne, you have the upper, the one hand pointing up, one hand pointing down, you have the male elements, the female elements, all of these things are completely unified in this one figure. And so therefore, that as a symbol of the universal agent being the equilibrium of all opposites is what might be referred to as that zero point energy that I'm referring to. Zero point in the sense that it is completely, it doesn't belong to any of those offshoots, opposites, in any sense. It's beyond them all. It is them all and beyond them all, kind of thing. And so in the sense of being something which is of therapeutic value, the state of presence is when one reaches this place and all one's sensory experience is equilibrated, so that one is not drawn specifically to the visual field, one is not drawn to the auditory field, one is not drawn to the physical field, because what is quite often the case with many individuals is that they are focused in one predominant channel of experience. And this is something that the NLP actually works with a lot. The system of NLP actually takes advantage of one's primary channel, if you like, and works with that as the entry point into the individual's sphere of being so that you can get the best results from working with them. So, like I'm saying, rather than working with existing conditions that are already out of balance, if one reaches a state of presence, one then becomes equilibrated, which one may regard as being the aim of what might be called the great work.
When subject and object are unified.
That kind of thing, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, it sounds like, from what you've described, that magnetism not only is, has deep esoteric roots, but also fits quite nicely in with, modern scientific paradigms as well.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, based on that, and I think also, greater acceptance of the ideas of psychology and power of the mind and whatnot, it would seem that magnetism or mesmerism or this therapeutic technique would become quite popular. Is that, you know, what you're finding?
I think it is gaining more acceptance, and I think it will gain further acceptance, because I do believe that, you know, people are always looking for something else. You know, there's always a need to find something else. Quite often people are not happy with where they are, with what they are, with what they're doing, and so on and so on. And so a lot of individuals have a tendency to, I mean, the whole of our culture is based on this thing of you know, we are not enough for ourselves, you see? And so as a result of this, that is a rather large point of our, I could go into some quite strange areas here.
Please do, yeah.
I was going to say, like, basically we are, it comes back to the presence, the aspect of presence again. The experience that one has when in a magnetic state is one is given a taster of that presence, that state of presence, which I keep mentioning. Mm-hmm. And it's that experience that enables one to understand that one was out of balance. And for example, again, because it's a purely experiential thing, this is very difficult to explain, but when one reaches a condition of presence, one understands how asleep one actually was. And so once a person has had that experience, it's very difficult to forget it. And what can tend to happen is that a desire of sorts sets in whereby one wishes to attain that state more and more, in a more and more permanent form. And I think a lot of people seek for various aspects of, say, you know, thrill seeking and so on, and they don't really understand that what's beneath that thrill seeking is a desire to re-experience a state where they really felt here, mm-hmm. you know, truly here. What I'm basically saying is, if we refer the idea of becoming awakened, and I suppose this is quite similar to the ideas of the fourth way, Gurdjieff's fourth way, and things like this, if we look at these ideas of awakening in that sense, that people are working in very mechanical states most of the time. Yes. This is what I'm saying. So we tend as human beings to work on the path of least resistance in just about everything that we do, which keeps everybody in a state of sleep. One might say in a metaphorical sense, some others may say in a very literal sense. And so the idea is that those mechanical ways of being are gradually dissolved through the practice of presence. And that state of presence in itself has a very strong contact with the essence of what I was talking about with the ideas of the quantum, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The quantum things I was talking about before.
Yeah.
When one reaches that state, it is a form of healing. So what we're essentially doing is we are attempting to bring people into that place so that they experience that state of equilibrium within themselves. That is the healing. That's when whatever problem on a psychological level or some other level, it may even be physical in the sense of physical pains, when that state is reached, the individual lets go of whatever loop was in place that held that in place. And it's freed so that the individual simply just experiences being rather than living in the, oh, my neck hurts, or, oh, I'm really not looking forward to this thing tomorrow, or, oh, this thing that happened to me in the past, it's really getting me down. All of that disappears. And so as a result of that disappearing, it's a bit like there is a chance to begin again. And this is the essential point that I'm trying to make about the zero point, if you like, the point of presence. Mm-hmm. And there are various ways that we use to get people into this place. And like I say, that it can be done through the forms of fascination, which is another aspect of our work. We use fascination, which is a form of fixation. You can also find these things on the videos. There's one video I've posted up already, which very clearly demonstrates fascination as a technique which was used by mesmerists, whereby one fixes one's eyes upon a subject and literally you don't move. And you have to train to not blink. This is the thing. You have to go through rigorous training for many, many weeks, many months, to be able to keep one's eyes open without any blinking whatsoever. And once that one has done this, you can then have much greater effects with fascination. And fascination is something which is found abundantly in the natural world. For example, I mean, it's something that lions do. It's something that snakes do, whereby in the case of a snake, for example, you have a some creature which is held completely in the gaze of the snake, and to all intents and purposes, really, the creature should be getting out of the way, but for some reason, they don't, and it's because of the what might be called the mesmeric action of the snake. So there is a very good example in nature of how certain beings may be frozen into place. As I mentioned on the video, there is a subject that I'm working with where I, for 25 to 30 seconds, stare into the eyes of the individual and hold the gaze in place to the point where the individual has completely lost any sensation of their body at that point in time, as if they're suspended in space. And then you will see on the video, I let go of the individual's arms, and the individual is literally frozen with their arms before them. And this aptly demonstrates what can be done with the gaze. Now, what you do by doing this is you create void points, and it's those void points in the individual that can then be used for therapeutic purposes.
Now, would you have any advice for people listening who might be interested in learning how to do this, or at least trying to get themselves in a position where they can, you know, experience that state of presence, even if they don't practice magnetism?
Well, I would highly recommend, of course, people who are interested in learning these techniques to actually to visit the school in Nice. That, mm-hmm. That is most definitely a recommendation. Mm-hmm. As I say, I myself do an introductory version of the courses in Nice over here in England, and also in the future I'll be working in the Massif Central in central France doing retreats, specifically working on presence, on the work of presence out in nature, out in the mountains. And that's a very good way of actually getting people into the right states, because out in nature, there's much less distractions. So I would definitely recommend and invite anyone out there who's interested in learning these arts, because they go so much deeper than I'm possibly able to explain on a show like today.
Sure.
And so, yes, there is so much open to people who are interested in this. And I would particularly say that individuals who have a tendency towards the working with the esoteric arts are particularly suitable to work with this, because in a very, very big way, I myself have been working with these things for so long now. And really, it's mesmerism is a path, and it's a path which is so extremely aligned to the Western mystery schools, particularly of the French and continental aspects. Yeah. So I would very much encourage people who are interested in these things to take a look, really.
Excellent. Do you mind if we take a quick break?
Absolutely not.
Okay, before we do, can you just quickly again remind people of your website and where they can find you online and how to get in touch with you?
Yeah, if you are interested in all of these things that I've been speaking about today, it's I would highly recommend you to get in touch with me via www.arcanatherapies.com, which is my therapeutic website, where you can find lots of material on where you can find videos, you can find essays, and you can book private sessions if you wish. And also there you will find course dates that are available as well for whatever course I will be running over here in the UK for people who can come to the UK, as well as the workshops and retreats that I'll be putting on regarding presence in the Auvergne in central France.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Lee Gerard Barlow, and just hang on and we'll take a quick break and be right back.
In the Occult of Personality membership section, mesmerist Lee Gerard Barlow discusses the importance of esoteric initiation and then explains some practical methods for experiencing the state of presence. Join us for that exclusive recording in the Occult of Personality membership section. The membership section helps support the podcast and provides members with access to well over 100 interviews, meditations, essays, and much more. Just browse to occultofpersonality.net/membership. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.